Chapter 32. The high desert wind shrieked across the airfield, throwing up towering clouds of dust that threatened to block out the sky. The pilot of the chartered Citation jet came in on the runway fully 30 feet to the left to account for the crosswind hammering the fuselage. The gear came down with a mechanical whine and thump, and flaps were extended. The turbojets roared to keep the aircraft aloft for a few more seconds. The sole passenger seated in the cabin paid no attention to the weather conditions or the dangerous landing. Since catching a commercial flight from Nice to London and then on to Dallas, where the leased executive jet was waiting, he sat with his laptop open and his fingers dancing across the keys. When Eric had come up with his plan to fire the Russian ballistic projectile weapon, it had been the barest outline of an idea. He hadn't considered the tremendous amount of data he needed to make it work. Orbital speeds, vectors, the rotation of the Earth, the mass of the tungsten rods, and 100 other elements. All had to be factored into his computations. With his naval background, he was more than confident he could do the mathematics, although he would have liked Murph's help. Mark had an innate grasp of trigonometry and calculus that would have made this so much easier. But then he would have insisted on taking command, and the chairman would have rightly given him the slot. Mark was simply more qualified to do this than Eric. Because this broke down to a communications exercise between the satellite and the computer, Holly Kasim would have been the next logical choice. The only problem was that Holly got sick on carnival rides and wouldn't have been able to do the work. Eric got tapped to do what only a handful of people had ever done. He would allow himself to get excited about it later, but for now, he had to work the numbers. He had told Jannika Dahl about needing to do this, embellishing the danger while not spelling out the reason. And with Mark trapped on the golden sky, he had stepped up his pursuit of the beautiful young Norwegian. He was already up to the 8th item on his courtship checklist and almost pushed it to number 9 by trying to hold her hand when he explained why he had to leave the ship. He wished he knew what it meant when she had cocked her head and parted her lips just before he left her in the infirmary. He should have asked Dr. Huxley. The plane touched down, swaying dangerously on two wheels for a moment before the pilot could kick in the rudder to even her out again. They taxied a long way. The airstrip was over 3 miles long and finally came to a massive hangar next to another unmarked executive jet. Above the hangar door was the name of a long-defunct airline. The engines spooled to silence and the co-pilot emerged from the cockpit. "Sorry, Mr. Stone, but we can't taxi into the hangar in this sandstorm. But don't worry, it's going to die down by tonight." Eric had already checked a dozen weather sites on the internet and knew to the minute when this cold front would move on. By tonight, there wouldn't even be a breeze. He closed up his laptop and grabbed his suitcase, an old Navy duffel that had followed him from Annapolis. The co-pilot opened the door and Eric fought his way down the stairs, slitting his eyes against the sand blowing across the tarmac. There was a man near a small door set into the larger hangar door waving him over. Eric jogged the 40 feet to the door and ducked through. The stranger immediately closed it. There was a large aircraft in the center of the hangar covered in canvas tarps. Its shape was hard to make out, but it was unlike anything else in the world. "Damn dust plays havoc on the planes," the man griped. "You must be Eric Stone. I'm Jack Taggart." "It's an honor to meet you, Colonel," Eric said with a touch of hero worship. "I read about you when I was a kid." Taggart was in his 60s, with a leathery, weather-beaten face and clear blue eyes. He was ruggedly handsome, like an idealized figure of a cowboy, with a firm jaw and a day's worth of silver stubble. He wore chinos, a flight uniform shirt, and a bomber jacket despite the heat. His handshake was like iron, and his baseball cap had the logo for one of the early space shuttle missions. He had been its pilot. "You ready for the ride of your life?" Taggart asked, leading him to an office in one corner of the hangar. His voice had a West Texas twang. Eric grinned. "Yes, sir, I am." There were two men in the office. Eric recognized one of them right away by his thick mutton chop sideburns. It was legendary aircraft designer Rick Butterfield. The other was a tall patrician figure with a shock of white hair. He wore a banker's three-piece suit with the chain of a Phi Beta Kappa key arcing across his waistcoat. Eric put his age on the high side of 70. "Mr. Stone," he said, extending a hand. "I so rarely get to meet members of Juan's team."
"Are you Langston Overholt?" Eric asked with awe.
"I am, my boy, I am. Although you have never, and most likely will never, meet me. Do you understand?" Eric nodded. "I really shouldn't have come at all. This is a private deal between the corporation and Mr. Butterfield's company, after all. That I wouldn't have agreed to if you hadn't threatened to gum up my certification applications with the FAA and NASA." Butterfield had a high-pitched voice. Overholt turned to him. "Rick, it wasn't a threat, just a friendly reminder that your aircraft hasn't yet been certified flightworthy, and that a word from me will cut a lot of red tape."
"You'd better not be yanking my chain."
"I think that my getting you a temporary certificate for this flight is proof enough of what I can do for you." Butterfield's expression remained sour, but he seemed mollified. He asked Eric, "What time do we need to do this?" "Using tracking data from NORAD, I calculate that to make an intercept I have to be in position at exactly 8:14 and 31.6 seconds tomorrow morning." "I can't guarantee you that kind of time accuracy. We'll need an hour just to get to altitude, and another 6 minutes for the burn." "A minute either way shouldn't make much of a difference," Eric said to reassure him. "Mr. Butterfield, I want you to understand the gravity of this situation. There are literally millions of lives counting on us. I know that sounds like a line from a bad spy novel, but it's the truth. If we fail, the people of the world are going to suffer in unspeakable agony." He opened his laptop to show the aeronautical engineer some of the footage taken aboard the Golden Dawn. The scenes spoke for themselves, so Eric didn't bother narrating. When it was over, he said, "Most of the people killed were the ones responsible for manufacturing the virus. The men behind this murdered their own people just to keep them silent." Butterfield looked up from the computer. His face was ashen under his farmer's tan. "I'm on board, kid. 100%.
"Thank you, sir."
"You ever taken any serious G's, son?" Taggart asked.
"When I was in the Navy, I was launched off a carrier. That was about 3, maybe 3.5.
"You barf easy."
"It's why I'm here, and another one of my associates isn't.
I'm a member of ACE, American Coaster Enthusiasts. I spend my vacations riding roller coasters. Haven't been sick once."
"Good enough for me. Rick?"
"I'm not going to have you sign a bunch of insurance waivers and all that boilerplate. I can vouch for my bird so long as you vouch for your health."
"My company gives us physicals every 6 months. There's nothing wrong with me that these eyeglasses can't correct."
"Okay, then. We have a lot of prep work to get done before morning."
Butterfield glanced at the big Rolex he wore on the inside of his wrist.
"My team should be here in 20 minutes or so. I need to get you and your gear on a scale to calculate weights and balance, and then I think you should remain on your aircraft until the flight. Your pilots can stay at the hotel in town. I'll have one of my guys drive them."
"That works for me.
Mr. Butterfield, I do have one request."
"Shoot."
"I'd like to see the plane."
Butterfield nodded and sauntered from the office, Eric, Taggart, and Overholt in tow. There was a handheld remote dangling from a long cord next to the shrouded plane. He hit a button, and a winch started to draw the tarp ceilingward. Painted glossy white with little blue stars, the mother plane, called Kanga, looked unlike any other aircraft in the world. It had gull wings like the venerable World War II Corsair, but they started high on the fuselage and angled downward so that the airframe sat on tall landing gear.
It had two jet engines above the single-seat cockpit and twin spars under the wings that tapered back to a pair of delta-shaped tail assemblies. But what was nestled under the larger plane was what held Stone's attention. Rue was a rocket-powered glider with a single flat wing that could be hinged upward to impart drag after it had exhausted its load of fuel. Capable of speeds in excess of 2,000 miles per hour, Rue was a suborbital space plane, and while it wasn't the first privately funded craft, it already held the record for altitude at nearly 120 kilometers, or almost 75 miles above the Earth. Rue was carried to 38,000 feet by Kanga. The two would separate, and the rocket motor would be engaged so that Rue screamed toward the heavens on a ballistic parabola that would carry it some 60 miles downrange. It would then glide back to its home base for refueling. The intention of Butterfield and his investors was to take adventure seekers on a suborbital flight so they could feel the freedom of weightlessness at the very edge of space. Eric Stone was about to become their first paying customer, although he wasn't after thrills. His idea was to time the flight so that at its apogee, he would be within range of the Russian weapons platform's damaged antenna. Using the codes Juan had gotten from Kirikov, Eric would reposition the satellite so it would launch one of its projectiles at Eos Island. The kinetic energy of the 1,800-pound tungsten rod striking anywhere on the island would obliterate the ELF transmitter.
"She's something god-awful ugly, isn't she?" Butterfield said with pride. He rubbed a loving hand along the composite fuselage. "What's it like flying in her?" Eric asked.
"I wouldn't know." Butterfield tapped his chest.
"Bum ticker."
The test pilot, Taggart, said, "Son, this thing is going to ruin you for them roller coasters you like so much, because this is one ride that'll top them all."
Overholt cleared his throat.
"Gentlemen, it wouldn't do for me to be here when Mr. Butterfield's people arrive, so I will bid my farewells."
He shook hands all around, his grip firm despite his age.
"Mr. Stone, please walk me back to my plane."
"Certainly, sir." Eric had to stretch his stride to match the elder man's pace.
"I would like you to convey to the chairman, the next time you speak to him, that I had a word with our friends at the National Security Agency. They also detected the ELF transmissions, one from your Mr. Henley, I believe, and the other one a short while earlier. The very fact that someone has gone to the expense of building such a transmitter caused a bit of a stir, as you can imagine. Coupled with what you and your crewmates have been able to discern, almost all of it unsubstantiated."
Eric opened his mouth to protest.
"I know you don't follow Justice Department rules, but there are legalities that must be followed if we are to prosecute Severance and his group. I helped grease the wheels for your little adventure tomorrow, so you know I am taking this threat seriously. But if we are going to expose the responsivist movement for the monsters they really are, I need facts, not second and third-hand accounts. Do you understand?"
"Of course, Mr. Overholt.
Just so long as you understand that without us acting the way we have, millions of people would be exposed to the virus by the time you found satisfactory evidence for said prosecution."
Eric didn't believe he had the courage to speak so frankly to the veteran CIA agent.
Langston chuckled.
"I can see why Juan hired you. Courage and brains. Tell Juan that things are in motion here that may help take down Severance once his transmitter is destroyed."
They paused at the hangar door because the wind would make it impossible to speak once they stepped outside.
"I wasn't told who thought up the crazy idea of using that Cold War relic the Ruskies left littering space."
"I did," Eric replied.
"I knew Juan would nix my first idea of talking you into getting us a nuke."
Overholt paled at that.
"Rightly so. I had to come up with an alternative, and when Ivan Kirikov mentioned Stalin's fist and I researched it, everything seemed to fit.
You know it was Cabrillo who sabotaged the satellite, right?
He mentioned it briefly.
Knowing him, he didn't tell you the full story. Juan spent 7 months behind the Iron Curtain, living the life of one Yuri Markov, a technician at Baikonur. The pressure to stay undercover for that long, and under the tight security the Russians maintained there at the time, must have been pure hell. When he got out, it was standard practice for operatives to see an agency shrink. They met for just a short while. I saw the doctor's notes. His summary was just one line. "That is the coolest customer I have ever met." Truer words have never been written.
Just curious, what happened to the real Markov? Juan didn't have to...
Kill him? Heavens no. We got Markov out in payment for first telling us about the orbital ballistic projectile project. Last I heard, he works for Boeing's space division. But I know this. If he had been ordered to sanction Markov, Juan wouldn't have hesitated. He has the strictest moral code of anyone I know. The ends justify the means for someone like Cabrillo. I know in today's politically correct world that outrages a lot of people, but they live in the freedom men like Juan provide. It isn't their conscience that bears the burden, it's Juan's. They just get to enjoy a false sense of moral superiority without understanding the real costs. Toss an animal lover into a pen with a rabid raccoon and he'll kill it. He will feel bad, even guilty, but do you think he's going to consider his peers outraged that he took that life? Not for a second, because it's kill or be killed. That is what our world is coming to, I'm afraid. Only people are too horrified by that concept to accept it.
Unfortunately, their acceptance isn't a factor to the forces arrayed against us, Eric said. Overholt held out his hand to shake again.
That's what makes our jobs all the more difficult. I fought my war when we all knew it was black and white. Since then, someone convinced us there is gray out there. Let me tell you something, son. There isn't any such thing as gray, no matter what you hear.
Overholt released Eric's hand.
It was a pleasure meeting you, Mr. Stone. Good luck tomorrow, and Godspeed.
Cutting like a knife through blue silk, the Oregon raced across the Mediterranean. They avoided shipping lanes as much as possible so they could run her magneto-hydrodynamic engines above the red line and not draw attention to her blazing speed. They slowed only once when passing through the Strait of Messina, separating the tip of Italy's boot from the island of Sicily. Fortunately, nature was in a cooperative mood. The seas were calm, and there was no trace of a breeze as they dashed across the Ionian Sea and entered the Aegean. Juan spent nearly every waking hour in the op center, wedged into his chair with a continuously recharged mug of coffee. In the top corner of the main viewing monitor, a digital clock remorselessly counted backward. In a little over 18 hours, Eos Island would be wiped off the face of the planet. And Max Hanley would go with it if Cabrillo didn't think of something soon. The ship didn't feel right to him. Eric and Mark should be at the front consoles, navigating the ship and preparing its weapons systems for her defense. Max should be at the rear of the op center, hovering over the engine monitors like a mother hen. Linda should be here too, ready to lend a hand to whatever section needed her. Eddie and Link must have felt the same way. They rarely spent time in the op center, but with so many of their friends in danger, there was no place else they would rather be.
"Nothing, Chairman," Halley said from his station along the starboard side of the high-tech room.
This was the third straight time that Linda and Mark had missed their appointed check-in time. Halley had contacted the cruise line and been reassured that there were no communications problems with the Golden Sky. He had even phoned the ship's communications center, pretending to be a passenger's brother with news of a dying parent.
The helpful secretary had assured him that she would get a message to cabin B-123, a number he had randomly picked. The passenger never called back, but that wasn't definitive proof of anything, since he may have already lost both parents and thought it a cruel hoax. Juan had dismissed the idea of trying a few others with the same ruse, because the receptionist would have grown suspicious. Even with the Oregon's vast arsenal of weaponry and the best communications system afloat, there was nothing anyone could do but wait. Wait until they were within range of EOS and hope that an opportunity presented itself. Max had figured out a way to elude his captors long enough to send the message, and the cagey old codger might come up with another trick or two yet. Juan had to be in position to help if he could. Then there was the situation with Mark and Linda. Juan had no idea what events were unfolding on the Golden Sky. For all he knew, they had been identified as stowaways and were in lockdown someplace on a ship he had no doubt Severance had rigged with his virus. They still hadn't figured out what Max had meant, that the virus did something worse than kill, but it didn't matter. If they failed to knock out the transmitter, two of his top people were going to be among the first exposed. Juan typed a command into his computer. On the monitor, the speeding seconds of the digital clock vanished. They had been reeling back depressingly fast, and he didn't want to watch them anymore. The minutes display was reminder enough. The time was running out.